Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Back with us today is Skidmore College President Philip Glotzbach, one of my favorite people in the Northeast. President Glotzbach confirmed his decision recently to step down as president of Skidmore in May 2020. He's been president of Skidmore since 2003. Also a philosopher and spokesman on issues of higher education, Glotzbach will step down as Skidmore's seventh president at the end of the 2019-2020 academic year. Over nearly 16 years, President Glotzbach has overseen a range of initiatives that have enhanced both the college's academic offerings and physical landscape. He has helped Skidmore College add new academic programs, instituted a first-year experience, greatly increased both the academic strength and diversity of the student body, significantly enhanced the college's commitment to financial aid, and opened a number of impressive new facilities that have increased the vitality and the college's living learning environment. So, Philip Glotzbach, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, Alan, thank you. It's delightful to be here with you.
And I don't think WAMC has had a more passionate supporter than you and your wonderful wife.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you for doing
it. WAMC deserves support, so happy to do it.
Okay, so let's go back to the very beginning. Born, raised, parents?
I'll make it short. I was born in Kansas City, mostly grew up in Dayton, Ohio. My father was a professional. He was in the audit field, and my mother was a homemaker, but she was a very good educator. I don't have siblings, so she concentrated on me, and she was very responsible for, I would say, much of my intellectual growth.
Yeah, looking back, do you ever wish you had a sibling?
Oh, from time to time, but I don't know what that would have been like, so.
Right. So you didn't have an imaginary brother or sister?
No, I did not. Uh-huh. I had a dog from time to time.
What was the dog's name?
The dog's name was Sport, but that was a long time ago.
That's cool.
Subsequently, we've gotten better dog names.
So, Philip Glotzbach, take us through your career a little bit. How did it all begin? When did you know you were going to be an academic? What happened?
Let me try to give you the short version of that. I really fell in love with the discipline of philosophy as an undergraduate. I was at Notre Dame, and in my spring semester of sophomore year, I'd already decided to be a philosophy major, and I discovered academic journals in the library. I was wandering through the shelves. Journals where people wrote philosophy papers and shared them, and I thought this was the most amazing discovery.
Wow.
And I wanted to be part of that field. And I went to Yale for graduate school, graduated in 1972 from undergraduate. And I was heading to graduate school and received a letter from the American Philosophical Association, which basically said, if you think you're going to graduate school to get a job teaching philosophy, forget it.
They told me that, too.
Right. So that was the word back then. Well, you didn't listen, and I didn't listen.
Right.
Did graduate studies at Yale, went to Denison University, taught there for 15 years.
What was that like?
I loved it. I loved teaching philosophy. I loved it at all levels. I loved teaching introduction. I loved advanced seminars.
What were the kids like?
They were, in many ways, very similar to the students we have today. It was a more homogeneous group, certainly ethnically, racially, and socioeconomically. That's all changed in higher education. But they were eager. We had great students in philosophy, but I enjoyed teaching introductory philosophy courses.
So interesting that you and I are on the same track. I loved it, too. And the more, the better, I always thought.
Right. It's wonderful to introduce students who have not had acquaintance with a discipline. And the advantage of philosophy is you don't find many philosophy courses in high school. So students really have no idea what the heck it's all about. And so you could really start from zero, which I loved.
So what were you teaching them? Who were the heroes of philosophy?
Well, at the intro class, I really thought it was more important to help students learn how to think about what I thought were important issues: ethics, right and wrong, responsibility, various theories about are we responsible for what we do, are we not responsible. Sometimes I got into philosophy of science. I mean, I had them read some standard things, some Plato, some of the existentialists, pieces from Sartre, and some Hannah Arendt. We had them read Eichmann in Jerusalem, which I think is a great case study in responsibility. We had them read B.F. Skinner's Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which is the entire opposite position. So a number of different things. Really wanted them, I had them read some Marx by the end of the course to think about the economy and the role of money in our society and so on, and how people, and a lot more, of course. But it was really an attempt to just help them broaden their intellectual horizons and learn how to think critically.
When did you meet your wife?
We met when I was an undergraduate.
Really? I didn't even know that there were women at Notre Dame.
Well, there weren't. She was at another school. It's sort of a long and tangled tale.
But,
she went to Clark College in Iowa, and it's now Clark University. At the time, it was a...
I know it.
Oh, women's
school. Quite a good school.
It is. Mm-hmm. Good school.
Yeah. So you now go on to Yale. Are you teaching classes at Yale?
I did. I was a teaching assistant, of course, for a number of different courses with professors. And I did, before I left, get to teach my own course at the end of my time there. It was a 2-semester intro to philosophy course, which helped me think about what I wanted to do when I got out on my own at Denison. And it was a great experience. We had great students. And in fact, I was a couple of years ago in an elevator in the Yale Club, and this fellow looked at me and said, "Professor Glotzbach?" And I had no idea who he was. And he told me his name, and he was a student in that class.
Wow.
And he subsequently has become a college president himself. So we had fun talking about that.
Wow. So what happens to philosophy majors? Where do they go? What do they do?
Well, most of them don't go into professional philosophy, although I certainly had some students over the years who did, who got PhDs. Mostly they went into everything. I mean, everything from medical school to managing to professional baseball to marketing.
Who is the professional baseball player?
He wasn't a player. He was in management, baseball management.
I
think he worked for the Phillies organization. It's really about anything you can imagine, banking. I mean, the nice thing about philosophy is that it does prepare you for just about anything. A number of them went to law school.
I just was going to say, you hadn't mentioned law school yet.
Law school, right.
Yeah. Well, Philip Glotzbach, the Professional Association told you you wouldn't get a job, but you did get a job. Which was that first job?
It was at Denison.
And how hard was it to get that?
I was very fortunate. It was not easy to get that job. I'm sure there were 200 or 300 applicants, and they were looking for a particular combination of specialties, which I convinced them that I had.
Which were?
They were actually looking for someone who had some knowledge of continental philosophy, so phenomenology and existentialism. And I had done some work in that area and was very intrigued with one particular philosopher, and we talked about that. But I also did work in the British and American tradition, and I think ultimately that was an advantage.
Wow.
So
I'm terribly impressed.
Well, I don't know how impressive it is, but really what happened was I convinced them that I could teach. And just like we do today at Skidmore, I had to teach a class, taught somebody's class, and they watched, and I was still relatively green, and I've learned an awful lot about teaching over my time there. When you come out of graduate school, as you know, you may think you know a lot about that, but as you get into the classroom, you learn quite a bit more, just again like our faculty members do here. And I was able, I think, to develop those skills a little bit more over time.
I've often thought it's like music. I have a friend up there in Saratoga near you named Peter Davis, who is a terrific instrumentalist. Mm. And, you know, I had been playing the banjo for a long time, and he said, "Let me see that thing." And he came back an hour later, played it better than I did.
One can only wonder about those things.
But can you teach teachers how to teach? You can teach them some stuff, but don't you think it's either you got it or you don't?
Certainly one brings a certain set of attitudes and beliefs. I think that that's one of the things that really can talk about. And I talk about this with our new faculty members every year when they come in for orientation. I think the most important thing is your attitude and your relationship toward your students, particularly at a smaller school like Skidmore, where we have small classes, where we really care about those relationships between faculty members and students. And so it begins with a profound caring about student success, wanting them to succeed. And then, I mean, you have to bring your disciplinary expertise, listening to students so you can hear where they might be having a problem or not quite understanding something, so you can talk about that in a way different from the way you just talked about it, because obviously it didn't work the first time. And so you need to listen to the questions that students have and try to respond to them. You need to be very imaginative today. I've been out of the classroom, Alan, since 1992. If I were to go back in teaching today, I would have to relearn a lot of it and learn some new skills. We really expect the classroom to be much more interactive today. We expect our faculty members to be creative, to be imaginative, to find ways to engage their students with the discipline so that the students are actively learning or doing the work. So you can help people learn all those things. We have a Center for Leadership, Teaching, and Learning at Skidmore where faculty members can come and really work on their pedagogical skills. Working today in a more diverse classroom where you're more likely to have students from different backgrounds and international students and so on, it's a much more complex environment than it was back when I was teaching. And really, it's very helpful to talk with other faculty members and to learn about ways to deal with situations that can come up in those classrooms. So I think you can learn a lot, but you do have to bring a fundamental desire to teach. You have to bring that fire in your belly for the discipline and the desire to share that. And you have to be able to make yourself vulnerable, because if I have something that I absolutely love and I choose to share that with you, you might reject it. You might basically tell me that you're not interested or that it's not valuable. So I have to be willing to risk that in order to be an effective teacher.
I've had professors who didn't do what you just espoused, which was to be somehow concerned about me. They were more interested in competing with me.
Well, certainly there can be ego involved, and I think that's not good. I heard about a professional philosopher at another school when I was in graduate school who walked into his class and said, "I am God." I don't think that's a good model. It's not a model that I chose. So people can learn from a variety of professors. And I say that to our faculty members. There's no one way to be an effective faculty member. So you have to be true to yourself. But I do think that if you really care about your students' success, that's the foundation of everything else.
I have a wife who I love very, very much, who is a Skidmore graduate and who thinks Skidmore is an extraordinary institution. She goes back far enough so that she lived in those older buildings in the middle of town before you
built... Right, the old campus, as we say.
Before you built the campus. But she was an education person there, and she talks about her professors there to this day. Amazing.
I believe that. We've always had great faculty members, and over the years, they've gotten stronger. And I shared our stories back in the 70s about how difficult it was to get an academic job, and it is that way today, or more so. And so... what I would say is that when colleges hire today, and particularly a school like Skidmore, which is an attractive place, and there are a lot of reasons for someone to come and teach here, not the least of which is our location in upstate New York and Saratoga Springs and all that, but the school is very attractive and the colleagueship at Skidmore is very strong. So if we're not hiring extraordinary people, we're not doing our job. And if you look back, particularly through the 80s and 90s, the previous president, David Porter, one of my predecessors, really focused on bringing some terrific faculty members here to build on the tradition that was there when Roselle was there. I mean, they've always had strong faculty members, but it's gotten better and better. And over my time at Skidmore, I've just seen our faculty get even stronger. We have terrific folks at all ranks. But our newly hired faculty members, people who've come in the last few years, I'd say are quite extraordinary. And they really care about teaching. And that's the first thing.
Do you?
But let me just say, Alan, excuse me, but they're also great scholars, researchers in their field. So we expect them to do all of that.
Do you talk to every potential applicant for a job?
I don't. It just doesn't work with my schedule because Marie and I are out of town too often on fundraising, and it would just make it, I could talk to some but not others, and that's not a good model. Our dean and vice president, dean of the faculty and vice president for academic affairs, does meet with every candidate or one of his associate deans. And I think that's very important. When I was, we didn't sort of go through my whole history, which is just fine, but after I left Denison, I went to the University of Redlands in Southern California. I was an academic dean and then a vice president. And I did make a point of interviewing every candidate for every position who came to the school, and I do think that's important, as much because someone in that position can help make the case for the school, to sell the school, but also to get some hands-on sense of who these people are who are coming in. And ultimately, the dean has to approve a hire. And I wanted to know something about the people who were being presented to me as the candidates of choice.
We're talking to Philip Glotzbach, the legendary, if I may say so, president of Skidmore College, a place which means a great deal to me because, Phil, I guess I didn't tell you this, but I got invited by one of the students there. And when I came up there, there was sitting my future wife. And that's how I met her.
Well, you're welcome, Alan.
Yeah, thank you.
A little service we provide from time to time.
Thank you for that. Okay, so I guess the question is, I see that you are wearing a label, and it says, Private Colleges, Public Purpose. When I was a younger man, the debate between the public and private sectors in New York was horrible. I mean, it really was blood-curdling, terrible stuff. But I think there's been a little bit more of an accommodation as I've grown a little bit older, unless that's just my perspective. What do you think?
I think that's true, Alan. I only have the perspective from 2003 when we came here, but I've been impressed by the public-private partnership that we've had, and particularly some of the legislation that's passed in New York State to support education in all our sectors. It's something that many people don't know, but there are actually more students attending private colleges and universities in New York than public, which is fairly unusual. We just have a broad range of schools. And so the private sector is enormously important overall. The legislature and various governors have responded, I think, appropriately to that, funding programs like TAP, Tuition Assistance Program, which goes to students directly, as you know, whether they attend private schools, public schools, and I think that's a great model. That was a model that was started by the federal government back with the GI Bill. If you think about it, that aid went directly to students, and they could choose the schools they went to. And that enabled a whole generation of returning GIs to attain college education, where previously only people from wealthy backgrounds really were able to do that. It created the middle class. It was a hugely important moment for our society, and it was government funding of individuals that enabled that to happen. We have Bundy Aid, which does go to institutions. That's terrific. We have HEOP, the Higher Education Opportunity Program, which funds private colleges and universities and publics as well. But to bring students who are high need academically, who may have had very challenging academic backgrounds, but who have great potential. And I can tell you that we have about 40 students in what we call our opportunity programs. HEOP funds students from the state of New York. We've expanded that to include some students from outside of New York, and we pay for that entirely. And in fact, we pay for all the students to some extent. The opportunity fund money from the state doesn't cover everything. But those students are all full need scholarship recipients, and those students tend to graduate at rates of 95 to 100% in 4 years. We're very proud of that. And their GPAs, their grade point averages, on average, are higher than the overall GPA of the college as a whole.
What accounts for that?
Well, first of all, they have great academic ability. They have high motivation. We do provide them with a bridge program in the summer before their first year just to help them get accommodated to higher education and really so they can hit the ground running in the fall. We do provide advising over the years, but those services tend to taper off as they go through the ranks. You know, the most significant factor, I think, I mean, we certainly have a program that helps them in many ways, but it's their motivation. They're highly motivated.
So people come to me all the time and they say, Alan, my kid could go to Skidmore, my kid could go to the state university. Skidmore costs a lot of money now. Now, I know you're going to tell me that a lot of people are on scholarship. I'll give you that. Nevertheless, how much does a full boat tuition to Skidmore now cost?
Well, it's over $70,000, which is a big factor.
How far?
A big number. It's about, I should know this. It's about 71 now, I think. So it's on close to 70.
Who in heck has $71,000? When you're done paying your taxes, that means you have to have at least $150,000 to send the kid to school.
It is a big number, Alan, and it's not a number that's out of line for private colleges and universities.
No,
so it's a lot of money. And there are people in our country and around the world who can pay that, and we're very fortunate that they can. We have in our entering class about 44% of our students on financial aid.
But we don't know how much financial aid.
Well, let me talk about that.
Oh, please.
I'm happy to do that because I think it's a very important story. Our financial aid at Skidmore, first of all, we meet full demonstrated need. There are fewer than 100 colleges and universities in this country who do that, which means once you fill out the financial aid forms, you get a number back that says this is your family's contribution, this should be the college's contribution, and so on. And to meet full need is to provide the institutional aid that represents, through a package of grants and loans and so on, that meets 100% of the demonstrated need. So the family has its contribution, the college has its. Most recent figures, the average Skidmore grant, not loans or anything else, the average grant was about $43,000.
Wow.
42. And the average net cost to families whose students received aid was $24,087. And so that shows the dramatic reduction in that, which we do for families who have demonstrated financial need. Now, let me just say, I'm really proud of that because, as I'm sure you know, schools today, colleges, universities, public, private, are investing great sums of money in non-need-based aid. Sometimes it's called merit aid. I really think that's kind of a misnomer. We have about 1% or less of our aid that goes to that.
And now, what is that again, merit aid?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. I mean, I think that the aid we provide really is merit aid. It's in two areas, our Filene scholarships in music, and students have to audition for that. And the finalists come to Skidmore and perform juried performance. So the top ones receive scholarships of about $15,000 from generous support from the Filene Ladd Foundation, and we provide income. The other merit scholarships we provide are Porter Wachenheim scholars, and those are for students who are very serious about entering the sciences. And again, they have to apply and compete for those scholarships in about the same amount. Otherwise, our aid is entirely based on financial need.
So, in other words, if you admit somebody, then it's going to be financial need rather than competence in music or...
That's right. And there are other forms of aid, non-need-based aid or merit aid, that schools increasingly rely on really to influence choice, to try to get the student to come to, you know, school X. We're going to give you a $10,000 presidential scholarship or a $15,000 university scholarship, whatever it is. And I'll give you an example, which is, I think, an interesting and illustrative one. The University of Kentucky has about 30,000, probably today 35,000 students. In 2017, their non-need-based aid represented 90% of their aid. In other words, that was aid that they were giving to students solely to influence them to come to the University of Kentucky. Now, they took a bold step. And by the way, their budget that year was $22 million. Our budget that year was about $42 million. Mm. So, you know, at a considerably smaller school. They decided, and bless their hearts for doing this, that they wanted to redistribute their aid so that their goal was to have 65% of their aid need-based and the rest non-need-based. But again, it just shows the environment that we're operating in, where state universities now, state schools, are providing aid to students not because they need it to attend for financial reasons, but simply to influence them to come to this school versus another school.
That sounds like a hit on the state schools, is it?
Well, it's not just state schools, it's private schools. Mm. And I'll tell you, it's a great example of Garrett Hardin's tragedy, The Commons, where a bunch of individuals make decisions that are individually rational, but collectively they become irrational. Mm. When I was at Denison back in the day, we sort of invented this thing. One of our deans came up with the idea of a scholarship, I think we called it a presidential scholarship, that was aimed at the valedictorians and salutatorians in Ohio high schools, because those kids were not coming to Denison. We thought, why shouldn't some of those kids come? Denison's in Ohio. Why shouldn't they come to us? And so we offered them a merit scholarship based on their academic performance to influence them to come to Denison. And it worked. We got some of those students. But then other schools saw that and started doing it. And it really started a movement. In the Midwest today, you really can't find a college or a university, public or private, that isn't really invested in merit aid. So what happens, ultimately, what happens is schools are competing for students based on, you know, this non-need-based aid. Students, in my opinion, end up pretty much going where they were going to go anyway, and they get an aid package unrelated to their financial situation, you know, for going where they were going to go anyway. What it does is cut down on the amount of need of aid, rather, that's available to students who can't afford to go unless they receive that aid, and it transfers aid to students who could afford to go, whose parents could afford to pay. So
what about
it's a tough situation.
Philip Glotzbach, what about outcomes in all of this? I mentioned people come to me all the time and say, should I spend my money at a private college, which costs $72,000 a year, or should I send my kid to State University, which is going to be in the 20s? Is there a difference? So I guess I want to ask you this. If you go to a private college like Skidmore, an excellent college, what do you get?
Well, it's a fair question, Alan. And look, I do not want to say, you know, Skidmore is better than University of Albany or something. You can't make that sort of blanket statement. One of the true strengths of American higher education is the diversity of types of institutions that you see. Publics, large publics, small publics, large, strong privates, and so on. I mean, they're just a range of choices. For some students, University of Albany can be a great choice and perhaps the best choice. For other students, Skidmore. Now, Skidmore represents a segment of the higher education population. If you took the top 100, however you want to define that, liberal arts colleges, we educate about 3% of the college population at any given moment. That's a pretty small fragment of the college population. So I want to say thank goodness we have larger schools as well. Otherwise, so many people wouldn't have access to higher education at all in this country. So it's very important that we have all these choices. Having said that, I think that what you receive for the cost of an education at a place like Skidmore is very close access to our faculty. Faculty who, I said before, who care about your learning, who are excellent professors, who are researchers, who are very smart. They're at the tops of their field. And so you have opportunities as an undergraduate to be pushed in small classes. You're in a seminar. You can't hide in the back. You have to participate. You get research opportunities to work with faculty members, you know, internships that we provide. If you are a student in the sciences at Skidmore, you are going to have a research opportunity which really is comparable to what you would have if you were in graduate school at a larger place. And if you were at a larger place, you might not get that opportunity because it would be the graduate students who are working with that equipment, who are working with those professors, and not the undergraduates. So let me just say one word about outcomes. If you look at the graduates from private liberal arts colleges like Skidmore, and you take measures of accomplishment such as Pulitzer Prizes, PhDs in chemistry, you know, whatever, pick your metric. Our graduates are overrepresented in those categories, far out of proportion to their numbers. Again, we're only 3% of the higher education population, and our graduates do outperform that 3%. So it really does work. And let me just tell you one other story, a personal story. My son, our son, went to Princeton, which is a terrific school. He had a great experience there, a wonderful experience. When he graduated from Princeton, he was applying to medical schools, and of course he needed a recommendation. There was one faculty member he knew well enough to ask for a recommendation. He had worked with great faculty members, and this person was world famous and gave him a great recommendation. But if you graduate from Skidmore, and Roselle could talk about this, and because it was true then, it's true today, you'll have 5, 6, 8 professors who know you, who know your work, who can write personal letters, and who care enough about your next stage, whether it's graduate school, law school, or a job, or whatever it may be, to write a letter that talks about you as an individual.
Talk to me about why Skidmore decided it, somewhere along the line, to admit boys as well as young women.
Well, it was a big diversity move at the time. You know, honestly, I mean, of course, I wasn't here. It was in the 70s. A lot of formerly single-sex schools were going co-ed at the time. More formerly all-male schools went co-ed. My alma mater, Notre Dame, was all-male until the fall after I graduated when they first admitted women. Skidmore admitted men, I believe, because the administration at the time believed if we did not do that, we probably wouldn't survive. I mean, again, times were changing. Single-sex schools were less in demand. The expectations of college students were changing. I mean, if you look at the landscape back then, in the 60s, let's say, there were just many more single-sex schools, all male, all female, very few today. There are few high-profile women's colleges, even fewer men's colleges, because students really wanted to go to a school where both men and women were there. And also, there was a time, again, my wife went to an all-women school, just like Roselle did. I think that in those times, it was enormously important for those schools to exist because it enabled women to have a very profound academic and educational experience without having to deal with the social expectations of the time that really privileged men. We've tried to work past that. I mean, we're still working on that today in our society, and we're working on it in colleges and universities. But in the 70s, the whole idea about education really started changing to say, look, men and women can be educated together. We have to figure out how to do that. They wanted that, so it was crucial for Skidmore's future. And today I can tell you that more than half of our faculty members are women, about 55% of our faculty. So we are a place that really is co-ed. And I'll just tell you one little story. When Marie and I first came to Skidmore, and really it was just at the very beginning, we had a group of students in the parlor of the president's house, Scribner House, and we're talking about things. And one of the students said, I know Skidmore wasn't always co-ed, but what I don't know, was it formerly an all-men's school or an all-women's school?
That's funny.
And I thought, okay, she can learn about it was a woman. She can learn about the history of her school in 10 minutes. That's fine. But what I loved was she couldn't tell that her experience was of an institution that was thoroughly co-ed, and she couldn't really tell whether it had formerly been all women or all men.
We're talking to Philip Glotzbach, who is the president of Skidmore College. Phil, you announced that in a year you're going to be gone, you're going to retire. I don't mean gone, because we certainly hope you'll live to at least 200.
But, I hope so too, Alan. Thank you.
But why'd you do it?
Well, it's going to be a different rhythm, that's for sure. And we will do some traveling. But I really am very interested in pursuing some writing projects that have kind of been on the back burner for a while. And I would love to have the time. I'm looking forward to having the time to do that.
What would you want to write?
Well, I'm working on a book with a co-author at the moment. It's been in the works for some time, about democracy in higher education. Mm-hmm. All of us say that in colleges and universities, we help prepare students to be responsible citizens. And I believe we do. But the question is, all right, so what exactly do people need to learn to be informed, responsible citizens today in this society? And how do colleges and universities teach them to do that? You don't do it by having a responsible citizenship course. And so really, it's the kind of things that you learn through your experience at a college or university. And I believe we can be a little more intentional about that. And so we're trying to articulate, for example, just one piece of this is scientific literacy. I absolutely believe that to be an informed, responsible citizen, to take part in our civic life today, you have to be scientifically literate. You don't have to be a Nobel laureate in physics, but you really need to understand how science works to a first approximation. You need to understand how the appeal to scientific data and theories and so on, our best knowledge in science, how that should factor into our public discourse and decision making. We do not do a very good job of that in this country today, and all you have to make that point, just look at our public discourse. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about. There are other dimensions to this as well.
How are you working on the book? Do you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning in your pajamas and sit there and write?
Well, I do tend to be an early riser. And when we're retired, I will get up and I will go to writing right away. But today, when I get up early, I have other things I need to do, which is why this book has been on the back burner.
So, Philip Glotzbach, what's the worst part about being a college president?
The worst part.
Have you ever had to fire anybody?
Sure. I mean, that's...
Is that right up there in the worst part?
Well, I think anybody who's in an administrative or a management position has that experience, so I don't know that that's unique to higher education or to a college president. That's certainly no fun. No one ever likes to do that. I think for me, the worst part is just worrying about our students, knowing that in a moment, you know, something can happen. Over my time at Skidmore, we've suffered 3 student deaths. And over now almost 16 years, that's not a huge number, but 1 is too many. And when that happens, you feel it personally. It's like one of your own kids. And worrying about the safety of students, and I'm talking about their physical safety especially, but students, you know, bring emotional issues to college these days and other kinds of issues. We have a much larger counseling staff today than we would have had, or we did have 10 years ago. That's true for colleges, universities in general. So there are a lot of things that can go wrong with students when they're 18 to 22. We know their prefrontal cortexes are not fully wired into the rest of their brain. And so the parts of these young people's brains that makes them adventurous and risk takers is fully firing. It's fully functioning. And that's what makes them good learners at that point in their life. But the part of their brain that says, you know, maybe you should think before you do this, is not fully wired in until they're about 26. And so that neurological fact is something that any college and university has to account for.
So does that mean that kids at college are more likely to commit suicide than the general population?
Oh, goodness gracious. I don't have that figure. And again, those students were not lost to suicide. It was accidents. I don't know that they're more likely. It's certainly, goodness, I should have this number in my head, but I don't. If you look at young people, suicide is either, and I'm talking about teenagers through the early 20s, I do believe that suicide may be the second largest cause of death. The first one is automobile accidents.
Right.
So I think you become less likely to take your life as you become older. Although we know that there are certain populations that are at risk. For example, we know soldiers coming back from active duty today are at significant risk. But it is an issue, and we worry about that. And we have a tremendous student life staff that takes that very seriously. I mean, students can get into trouble by drinking too much, you know?
Sure.
Newsflash, college students drink, regardless of what the laws are or what we try to do. And we do a great deal, and all colleges and universities do this, to try to educate students, to help them understand the dangers of alcohol and drug use. It, again, neurologically, it turns out that young people in their teens especially are especially vulnerable to drug and alcohol use because they're at risk of becoming addicted, more so than use later in life would give them. So we have to worry about all those things, and we do.
So I wanted to ask you about when you go to raise money. I'm a student of people who do that successfully.
Because you do that well.
No, I do it well on the radio, but I'm not particularly good at it when I confront somebody who has some money.
Right.
And having to say, you should give it to us. Now, many people have counseled me and said, if you believe in your mission, it'll work. But you obviously have been very successful. What's the secret of that success?
Alan, if you believe in your mission, it will work. I mean, that is the core of it. You really have to believe, and I know you do for WAMC, and I certainly
I do
for Skidmore. And that passion comes across when you do fund drives, when we hear you on the radio, and I hope that passion comes across when I speak with people. It really is a matter of talking about the value that the school represents for students today, the value it's represented in the past. Pick a student who's here today. There's no college without the generosity of people in the past. That's the only reason we're here today. That's the only reason we have an endowment. That's the only reason we have scholarships. The only reason we have science labs or music building, and to help people understand that.
I know of a very successful college president. I'm not going to name the institution, but he can raise money to put somebody's name on any building.
Right.
But having to raise money for the general fund to keep the place going, that's much harder for him. What do you make of that?
I think it's a general trend, Alan. It is harder to raise money for the annual fund. We call it the Skidmore Fund. I don't know, for a number of reasons. Participation in college fundraising and annual fundraising overall has been decreasing in recent years. I think in part that's due to the fact that there are so many worthy causes out there. I mean, how many pieces of mail do we get every day in your mailbox and my mailbox for causes that are terrific causes, everything from, you know, UNESCO to ASPCA to WAMC to Skidmore. And so there are a lot of choices. Young people, especially today, like to give to causes where they think they can see the immediate effect of their giving. You certainly can see that at a college like Skidmore, but we try to help them do that. So, you know, again, it's talking about the value that we represent. It's trying to help people feel pride in their institution. Oftentimes we're talking about, we're talking to alumni, and we want them to feel that pride, and again, to help them understand that the school that they attended was there and could offer them the opportunities they received only because of the generation of others, and you need to pay that forward.
You can't take it with you. That's for
you
sure.
You can't take it with you.
And so when you're deciding what should happen to it, it seems to me it's always been that people really care about their colleges.
They do.
And there's a reason for that.
Well, I think the reason is that, and particularly as you get on in life, I see this in myself, I tell incoming students that scarcely a day goes by that I don't wear my college ring, because that was such a formative moment in my life that it's just a part of who I am. And I think people, as they go on, become even more appreciative of that. A lot of our fundraising goes to our parents, which is very interesting because we love to have all of our parents participate in that, but obviously I'm talking primarily to parents who are already paying our full comprehensive fee, and so they're already writing big checks, and those parents in many cases are philanthropic and they're very generous. Our parent fund last year, our senior parent gift, which targets the families of the graduating seniors, raised $1.3 million. Mm. I mean, that's an amazing, and you know what it takes to do that. These are the analog for a hospital. They call it grateful patients. People who've had their lives saved by the hospital frequently give back to the hospital. For us, it's grateful parents. They see the changes that have happened in their sons and daughters as they've gone through Skidmore. They see the emergence of this young person who is quite different from the person who walked in the door 4 years before. And they feel grateful, and they understand that they can help us continue to do that for other students. And so we talk to them, too.
So let me talk to you about some academic politics.
Sure.
My experience for a long time in the classroom is the ugliest part of the academic life are those people who get tenure and those people who don't. And as the president who sits at the top of the heap, a lot of pressure on you, isn't there?
Well, the tenure process is enormously important, and there aren't many professions where you have a moment after you've been there, whether it's up or out. And making partner in a law firm is an analogous moment.
Yeah.
I mean, tenure is enormously important, and I think, frankly, tenure is an institution that's helped make American higher education what it is today, because it has protected people, particularly in times when the politics of the world have tended to intrude in the politics of the academy, where people could be punished for expressing unpopular beliefs and so on. You can go back, tenure as an institution was created right at the beginning of the 20th century. Go back to the McCarthy era and so on. I mean, all those times. So I think tenure has been enormously important. Every college or university has its processes for evaluating a tenure candidate. And tenure is really an inductive bet. It's a bet about the future. So you, Alan Chartok, have been at Skidmore for 6 years. You've shown yourself to be an excellent teacher, and we really look for excellence in teaching. You have shown that you are passionately involved in your discipline. You have published peer-reviewed research. You've shown that you're active. But when we give you tenure, we're betting that you're going to continue to do that into the future.
Well, does everybody do it? Or do some people, as the old saying goes, turn over and say, okay, now I can retire, stay and retire?
Very few. And that's something that I would say, I mean, I've been in the academy as a professional for over 40 years now. And every school has a couple of faculty members that one could point to. But very, very few. And I've been at three institutions now, and I'll say that unequivocally. Tenure really is bringing someone into a partnership with an institution. And I say this to people who've just received tenure at Skidmore. I used to say it at Redlands. You now have a kind of ownership stake in this college that you didn't have before you got tenure. We expect you to participate in the governance of the college in a way that you didn't before you knew whether you were going to get tenure or not. It is a very important moment in the life of any academic, and not everyone is successful, and that's a tough moment. At Skidmore, we hire well enough that the vast majority of our people are successful, and I'm very proud of that. So I'm in favor of tenure. I think it's a good institution. I think it's helped colleges and universities in general. I think it helps Skidmore, and it's something that we take very, very seriously. And there are a lot of people who are involved in the process, from the department to our tenure and promotion committee to the dean's office. All of them make recommendations that come up to me, and we tend to have recommendations that are consensus. People agree.
Have you ever had a tragedy story? In other words, somebody who comes to you, they were counting on it, they didn't get it, and they make an appeal.
Well, people have appealed for various reasons. The ad misery accordium argument is not really the argument that one wants to make. And typically an
appeal... Could you translate that?
From misery. The argument from misery is not the argument that can be effective in that moment. But because if you fail to get tenure, it's a very tough moment in your life, in anybody's life. There's no question about that. No, the appeals to tenure decisions really have to do with process. If there was some failure in the process at some level, something was supposed to happen in your career at the institution that didn't happen or vice versa, there are very few successful appeals. Sometimes there are. The remedy for that is to go back and take another look or to have someone have a second chance. Very, very, very rarely, very rarely. But the remedy is not to give that person tenure. Typically.
Have you ever been sued as an institution?
Well, we're in a very litigious society, Alan, and we do get suits, yes.
And what do you do then?
We have attorneys.
Yeah. It's something that I think every not-for-profit person, whether it's a college or a radio station, always worries about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A very wise man said to me recently, however, on our board, any settlement is better than any lawsuit.
Well, sometimes that's true, and you need to make a decision. Every college and university has liability insurance.
Sure.
And we work with our insurer, and they are involved in decisions about these cases, and sometimes it makes more sense to settle.
They can tick me off, by the way, those insurance companies, because there's everything in it for them to settle, even if you're in the right. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. Sometimes it can be advantageous. We have a good relationship with ours, and it's a firm that's quite widely used in higher education, and I feel very good about them. And they're very smart at not just deciding individual cases, but providing schools information about the legal landscape and information about how to avoid lawsuits and so on. You know, it's case by case, Alan. There are times when you just say, this case is ridiculous, we're going to fight it tooth and nail, we're going to go all the way. Other times you fight it and then end up with a settlement that just makes sense. It's all individual.
Needless to say, as I've already told you in private, I'm very disappointed that you're leaving as the president of Skidmore, because Philip Glotzbach, I'm a big fan and have been. But you look back and say, okay, if I could have done it over, here are some of the things I might have avoided.
That's a tough question, Alan. I mean, look, I appreciate your very kind comments. I do not believe I'm perfect and I could go back over places where, you know, I could have done this or could have done that. I think in general I've been very fortunate. I've been very fortunate to have very strong senior leadership. I've been very fortunate to have...
Well, that's on you, right? I mean, you had to choose them.
Well, in some cases they were there when I came. In other cases, today our senior leadership team is all new, except for one person who's absolutely terrific, our dean of admissions, who has been there longer than I have. But I've been fortunate to have very strong senior leadership who've helped me stay out of trouble, people who've provided wise counsel and very good work in their areas. And as a president, one learns very quickly that you get criticized for things that aren't necessarily your fault, but you also get praised for things that other people have done. So, you know, I think that we've been pretty lucky over the years that things have worked out pretty well. You know, there's not some major thing I would point to.
Okay, so
and it's probably that I've just repressed them, whatever they are.
I get that part. You just mentioned the word admissions. That's interesting. Skidmore is not an easy college to get into.
No, it isn't.
So do you ever get leaned on by, let's say, somebody who's given you a lot of money or who might be persuaded in your mind to build you a new library?
I've never in my time had a conversation with somebody who said, if you admit this student, I will give you a large gift. We certainly have conversations with people whom we know, and some of them are donors and others are alumni and whatever, who say, gee, I'd really like you to take a look at this student. And, you know, we do that. We make sure. I mean, our admissions people are enormously thorough. This year we have about 11,000 applications, Alan, and we're trying to bring in a class of about 690.
Wow.
So, you know, those are big numbers. But our admissions people are just amazing. And every application is read by at least two of our admissions counselors. And our dean of admissions is the one who, in the end, and she's actively involved in that process, so she's reading applications as well.
So you have to say no to 9 out of 10 people, basically?
Well, not 9 out of 10. It's about 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10.
Yeah. Our acceptance rate last year was, I believe, 27%.
So do you have a sense when you admit somebody that they're going to come or not come? Well, why should we even admit this person? They're not going to come anyway because it's all straight A's at Horace Mann in New York.
Yeah. We take a look at those students, and it is true that some students might apply the term as safety school. There was a time when Skidmore was perceived as more of a safety school than it is today. Today, it's a school of first choice by the vast majority of our students who come there. You know, students are shopping. They're out there in the admissions marketplace, and students, on average today, will submit, what, 8 to 12 applications, somewhere in there, maybe more. It's a large number. And it's a feedback loop that schools like Skidmore and other schools are partially responsible for this, because as we become more selective, it's less a sure thing for a student to apply to us or any other place, and so they feel they have to apply to more schools, and so that raises the number of applicants. But let me go back to your question. In my time here, I've never had somebody come to me and say, you know, if you admit this student, I'll give you X. We've had people who say, I'd really like you to admit this student X. If the student is admissible, somebody we want to admit, and our primary criterion is a belief that this student will succeed. That's it. We do not admit students who we don't think succeed. We have said no to some of those students in cases where we didn't think that student was prepared to come to Skidmore and succeed. And in a few cases, we've said, we would like this student to go to another school, a community college or something, for a year or 2 years, show us that this student can do college-level work, come back, reapply, and we'll take a look.
Okay, so you're an educator, you're a philosopher, and you, of course, are Philip Glotzbach, the president of Skidmore. I wanted to ask you really quickly. We have a president of the United States who some people, I'm one of them, consider to be really, really offensive, to the point that we believe, some of us, that he's put democracy in real potential danger. About a year ago. How do you feel about answering a question like that?
It's challenging because as a president of a private institution, we really try not to take political positions. And I think that that is appropriate. I look at politics as both a short game and a long game. The short game is what can you do to influence the political world today? And I think all of us as citizens, I vote, I give money to political causes and so on, and I'm engaged in that. But as a college, we're not in the short game. We're not in the business of taking positions or endorsing candidates. We're in the long game. We're preparing students, as I said earlier on here, to become informed, responsible citizens. That's a sentence, a phrase that's in our mission statement, and I take that seriously. So I would prefer not to comment on our current president. I think, and this is hardly a controversial statement, I think that we are challenged. Our democracy is challenged today. One of the largest challenges is what's happening through social media. I would call it an epistemic challenge. It's a challenge to knowledge, challenge to the concept of truth, a challenge to how we as a population, as a society, as citizens, find out what we want to believe. One of the fundamental principles of liberal education is that each of us is responsible for what we believe, and I deeply believe that. You, I, everybody, we make the determination at a certain point, but we don't just do it at random. We base that on whatever we base it on. And we've seen in the last couple of years especially that the internet has really changed that dynamic, in part because it's so easy for people to get information that reinforces what they already believe. The echo chamber. And so many of us, and I fall victim to that as well, or cable news. It's very easy to watch a news channel that pretty much reinforces what you believe, not 100%. And so what we have as a society is this enormous political polarization. We have seen a significant increase over the last couple of election cycles of the number of landslide districts across this country, districts that were won by one party or another in a landslide.
And that could be because of the gerrymander, couldn't it?
Well, gerrymandering is part of it, and it's also because this really interesting phenomenon that people increasingly are moving to places where they have like-minded people politically. You know, Alan, back in our day, your day and my day, there was a term mixed marriage. It was in the Jewish tradition. I was raised a Catholic. A mixed marriage for us was a marriage between a Catholic and a Protestant or anybody else. Today, a mixed marriage is between a Democrat and a Republican. I mean, this is what's happening in our society. And so I really worry about that because ultimately, if we cannot have civil discourse, if we cannot talk across political differences, if we can't find ways to change our minds, whether it's my mind or your mind, and I think that's the most important political question anybody can ask. I wish they would ask it on the Sunday morning talk shows and wait for an answer. What would it take to change your mind? And then just wait and get the answer. Because answering that question really forces somebody to say, what's the basis for my belief? And if I tell you the basis for my belief, I may not change my mind, but I can tell you what would change my mind. And the capacity to change one's mind through conversation, through political discourse, is fundamental to a democracy. That's how you achieve compromise. That's how you achieve a majority in a situation that might not have started with one side or another side or whatever side having a majority view. So that's what I believe.
Well, I must say, I could go on with you for hours, Philip Glotzbach. As I have said too often during the show, I really do regret the fact that you've decided to retire in a year, but at least we have you for a year more. And you're a huge citizen of our area. And we are grateful for all you have done, both for WAMC and also for the quality of life in our area. So, Philip Glotzbach of Skidmore College, we welcome you, and we hope that when you're done, you'll come back and talk to us some more.
Well, Alan, you're very kind. It's always a pleasure. Be happy to talk with you anytime about anything. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.